What does healthcare reform do for women? When a majority of women want and use birth control, why are we having a national debate about insurance coverage of contraception? Hear from the National Women's Law Center's senior health policy analyst, Anna Benyo, as she gives us the scoop on benefits impacting women. All of this next on Women's Health Today. This is Women's Health Today, about women for everyone. How do sex and gender impact health? Does health policy adequately address systemic problems rooted in the relationships between patient, provider, and insurer? Women's Health Today looks at health from an interdisciplinary and women-centered perspective, examining the many biological, psychological, and environmental factors affecting health. I'm your host, Giovanna Rossi. I've been working on women's issues and health policy for 15 years at the national and state levels. I was the director of New Mexico's first women's health office, and I'm currently the president of Collective Action Strategies, a consulting firm dedicated to working with public and private sectors to improve the health and lives of women and families. The program today includes an interview with National Women's Law Center's senior health policy analyst, Anna Benyo, about how healthcare reform impacts women. Stay tuned for Women's Health Today, right now, right here. The new healthcare law, the Affordable Care Act, protects women from discriminatory health insurance practices, makes health coverage more affordable and easier to obtain, and improves access to many of the health services women need. Approximately 17 million women will gain coverage because of the Affordable Care Act. Millions of women are already benefiting from the law, and there are important protections women will gain when the law is fully implemented in 2014. Parts of the law already in place include health plans covering certain preventive services, such as mammograms, flu shots, and colon cancer screenings, at no additional out-of-pocket costs, such as copayments. Over 20 million women are receiving preventive services without a copayment. The law also allows young adults to remain on their parents' health insurance until age 26. Over 2.5 million young people have gained insurance coverage through the healthcare law. The law prohibits lifetime limits on most benefits. Nearly 40 million women no longer have lifetime limits on their health coverage. Also, insurance companies are no longer allowed to cancel health insurance policies or drop coverage when people become sick. And children with pre-existing conditions can no longer be denied health coverage. Starting in 2014, all health plans must cover maternity care, and women will no longer be treated like a pre-existing condition and be denied insurance coverage for a history of pregnancy, C-section, or even medical treatment for domestic or sexual violence. Also in 2014, individuals and families may be eligible for tax credits to help pay for their insurance. To discuss the healthcare law, I visited the National Women's Law Center. I'm speaking today with Anna Benyo, Senior Health Policy Analyst at the National Women's Law Center. Welcome to the program, Anna.
Thanks, Giovanna. Good to be here.
We're sitting in your office on DuPont Circle here in Washington, D.C., and it's a little overcast outside, but it's a pretty nice day in D.C.
It is.
I wanted to talk to you about healthcare reform. You have been working on the new healthcare law since you started here at the National Women's Law Center. And I understand we are coming up on the second year anniversary of the passing of the law. And, you know, when I talk to people about healthcare reform, people either don't really know how it's affected them or they're not sure what is going to happen in the future. Can you just give us a really clear synopsis of what has been put in place already for women, and what can we expect later this year, because there are some other provisions going into effect later this year as well?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me on your program, and I love talking about the healthcare law. So this is a great opportunity to talk about many of the provisions that have already taken effect and some that are coming down in the next couple of years. So the first thing I just would clarify for everyone is just to, so we're all on the same page, the healthcare law was passed in 2010. It was on March 23rd, 2010. It was signed into law by President Obama. And the healthcare law reformed our private market system to make coverage more affordable and more fair for women. And it also expanded the opportunity for people who are uninsured to get insurance coverage. So I'm going to walk through some of the ways that the law reforms our current system and added some new provisions that will help make insurance more affordable and more fair. So one of the major things that the healthcare law did was allow a number of provisions to increase access to insurance. So one very popular provision that was part of the healthcare law is that young adults under the age of 26 can now stay on their parents' insurance plan. And we know that that was a major gap for people who either left college and didn't get a job right away, certainly something we've seen in the recession. It's also an issue for people who were looking for work, perhaps out of high school, and they were dropped immediately from their parents' insurance at age 18. And that was a big gap that we saw in uninsurance rates for young people. And that gap has actually gone down. It's one of the few areas where the uninsurance rate has actually decreased over the last 2 years, and that's the numbers that we see with young adults. So at this point, young adults have that ability to stay on their parents' insurance, and we know that over 2.5 million young people have gained insurance because of the healthcare law. So that's one really important provision and a very popular one that a lot of people have experienced. One of the things that the law does is it expands the ability for coverage. So, for example, 17 million women who are currently uninsured are going to gain coverage through the Affordable Care Act. One of the ways that this happens is through expanding the ability for people to get insurance in the individual and small group market through these places called state-based exchanges. The state-based exchange will be like an online marketplace where women can go and shop for coverage for their family members, for themselves, possibly for their spouse, for basically anyone in the family who needs insurance coverage. One of the things I'd like to stress is that the healthcare law really strengthens the employer-based insurance that people currently have. So the majority of us get our insurance through our job. That does not change under the healthcare law. That stays the same. We have the ability to keep that coverage that we get through our employer. But what the healthcare law does is it strengthens the ability to keep our insurance. What happens is that if we do lose our insurance because we lose our job or our spouse loses our job and therefore we lose coverage as a dependent, we can go into these state-based exchanges and be able to purchase coverage there. The healthcare law also provides tax credits for people, for small businesses and for individuals and families up to certain levels, depending on your income, to buy insurance in the exchange. One of the things we hear over and over from women is just the cost of coverage is so high. And so the state-based exchanges are going to allow everyone to kind of get in the same pool together and pool their resources, and the government will provide assistance in the form of tax credits to help make coverage more affordable.
Tax credits to employers?
Tax credits actually go straight to the plan. So some are employers get tax credits that will incentivize them to provide coverage for their employees. And in other situations, say, for example, you're a consultant or you run your own business or you purchase insurance in the individual market, when you go into the state-based exchange, the online sort of area where you can shop apples-to-apples comparisons for coverage, the amount that you'll pay in your premium will be offset by tax credits. And that's to basically to help bring down the cost of the premiums and make sure that people are able to get coverage. There are a few other areas that we think are really important in the healthcare law. One is in the area of prevention. Prevention is a very important area that hasn't been given as much focus because we really want people to prevent getting sick in the first place. So the healthcare law does two major things around prevention and preventive services. One is that it makes insurance companies provide preventive services, a list of preventive services at no cost sharing, which means no out-of-pocket costs such as copayments and deductibles. This, we think, is going to go a huge way to improving the health of Americans, because one of the things we know is that cost is a real barrier. People with, for example, high deductible plans may forego a lot of preventive services because they have to pay out of pocket or have to pay co-payments to get screenings and annual visits. And that's one of the things that the healthcare law tries to address, is that more people can get preventive care through without having to pay extra out-of-pocket costs.
And have these preventive services gone into effect already? Because I know some of them are still coming in later this year.
Great question. So there are a number of preventive services that have already gone into effect. They include mammograms, flu shots, colon cancer screenings. Over 20 million women are right now receiving preventive services without a copayment.
And do they get that under their current plan or only new plans?
It's all new plans. And this is something we'll come back to over and over again, is whether or not a prevention, you know, a lot of people, when they hear about a certain provision, they say, do I get this? So one of the things that the law does is it differentiates between what's called grandfathered plans and new plans. Over time, everyone will be in a new plan. So some people are seeing that right away because they're in a new plan right now. Their plan changed enough from when the law was passed that they're now considered in a quote-unquote new plan, and they're getting these preventive services. And over time, everyone will be in, it'll feel like your same coverage. It'll be with your same company and all of that, but it will have changed enough that some of these provisions will take effect. So we know now that 20 million women are receiving these preventive services, and many more will over the years to come. There's another provision that was part of the law that specifically addresses women's preventive health services. So these are services that are specific to women's needs, women's health needs, and these include the full range of FDA-approved methods of contraception, a well woman visit, screening for gestational diabetes, breastfeeding support and supplies, and counseling and screening for domestic violence. And these these services that I've just listed are provided the women's preventive health services that the Institute of Medicine said were these services were really important for women and for women to maintain healthy lives and healthy families. And those will also be provided at no cost sharing, no copays or deductibles. And those services will start to take effect August 1st, 2012 of this year. So that's something to look forward to.
So we can look forward to those, but again, that's only in new plans.
Correct.
So how long might an average woman wait for her coverage to include those preventive services?
Well, it's interesting. We see that a lot of insurance companies are starting to provide it right now because it makes good public health sense. They know they'll have to comply with this eventually. And so, for example, my insurance plan is starting to cover preventive services at no cost sharing, not the women's preventive health services, but overall the preventive health services, because they know that over time they're going to have to comply with the law. And also they think it's good for their consumers. And so most studies have shown that by 2014, 90% of plans will be considered new plans, quote unquote, and will be providing these services. So you really don't have that long to wait to get something like methods of all the full FDA-approved methods of contraception at no cost sharing. We think that most women will have that provision taken effect for them by 2014, and certainly by 2020, the vast majority of plans. Again, you're not gonna have a different company necessarily. You're gonna have the same doctor. You're gonna be in what feels like the same plan, but it would have changed enough to kick in this benefit, and you'll be getting the women's preventive health services and the preventive health services at no cost sharing.
I've been speaking with Anna Benyo of the National Women's Law Center. She's a senior health policy analyst, and we're talking about the healthcare law that was signed by President Obama in March of 2010, and getting up to speed on what's happened in the last couple of years and what we can expect to see later this year. And also, I know we have some information coming out from the Supreme Court as well. Let me ask you, Anna, there's been a lot of discussion and debate lately about birth control and coverage by insurance companies of forms of contraception and birth control for women. Where are we with that, and why are we having to debate this right now? It
seems like it was covered in the law. Women want birth control. Women depend on birth control for family planning. What's the debate, and where are we with that?
Sure, it's a really good question. I wish I knew why we were still debating this. It's something that over 98%, 99% of women use. Women of all faiths use contraceptive prescriptions for planning and spacing their births to be able to support a healthy family. So this is actually not a very controversial issue that has, unfortunately, been wrapped up in a lot of politics in the last few months. So I will just spend a few minutes talking about what the law does and the religious exemption that's in the law right now, and hopefully that will clarify some of this for your listeners. So as I mentioned, birth control is not that particularly controversial. The vast majority of insurance plans right now cover contraception, and the vast majority of women at some point in time of their lives between, say, their teenage years and into their later years will use contraception at some point in time in their life. So what the healthcare law did was it, as I mentioned before, it created these women's preventive health services. And it actually didn't talk about what the services should be. It was an amendment that said that asked, basically, the secretary to identify, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, to identify what kind of specific services women needed to stay healthy. That's the Women's Preventive Health Services. The Institute of Medicine took on that charge. The Secretary of HHS asked the Institute of Medicine to develop a list of services that women need. The Institute of Medicine is a nonpartisan panel of experts. They're providers, doctors, researchers, public health experts, and they took this question very seriously, and they came out with a list of 8 services that they think are important for women's health needs, that they were so important that they wanted them to be provided at no cost sharing. And the reason that the cost sharing matters is because we know that cost can be a major barrier for women to try to get care. It can be a barrier to getting your prescriptions on time. We've heard stories that women will not take prescriptions as directed because they're trying to, you know, save on the cost and try to space it out. Perhaps they're using their birth control pill every other day instead of every day, for example. So that the Institute of Medicine recognized that cost was a major barrier, and they also recognized that these 8 services were so important to women and to women's health that they need to be provided at no cost sharing. So it was the Institute of Medicine that made that decision about birth control. And after the Institute of Medicine decided that they had listened to testimony from a number of experts and they decided on this list of 8 preventive health services for women, the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the administration decided that they were going to adopt the Institute of Medicine recommendations in full, which they did, and they included an exemption for churches and houses of worship. They did not include universities or religiously affiliated health plans, for example. They basically said that if you're at a church or a house of worship, you work for a church or a house of worship, that you do not have to provide contraception if it's against, presumably against your moral beliefs. This is what sort of kickstarted a large conversation that we've been having for the last few months. That was the interim rule that the administration put out. And there was a lot of lobbying on all sides of the debate, and there were bishops who felt that it should have gone further. Particularly the Catholic bishops wanted the exemption to apply to hospitals, universities, basically any religiously affiliated employer, because they felt as though that as a religiously affiliated employer, they don't have to provide contraception or sterilization for that fact. And so they lobbied heavily to have that particular, what we call religious exemption, expanded and to include a lot more people. So the administration reviewed their thoughts, they listened to other experts, and they came up with what we call an accommodation. And this is a really balanced approach. It was our position at the National Women's Law Center that women, that any rule that come out makes sure that women get the coverage, that they get the services, they get the care that they need. So the Obama administration, taking into account the needs of the bishops and some other religious communities, basically decided that it would be on the onus of plans to provide the coverage. So a religious employer isn't going to be the one providing contraception, it's going to be the insurance company. And the cost for that service will be part of everybody's premium. So this got out of the sticky situation of whether or not employers themselves were providing something that they didn't agree with. And instead, it became the right of the insurance company. So the insurance company has to provide the full range of FDA-approved methods of contraception at no cost sharing for women. And it's up to women to decide whether or not they want to take it, if it's within their religious and moral beliefs, whether or not they want to avail themselves of this benefit. But that benefit is there for all women. And that is an accommodation that we think is fair and balanced. The accommodation for religious houses of worship and churches remains. So if you work at a church or a house of worship, you do not, your insurance plan will not cover this.
Okay. Okay. And I know that we are heading now into a possible Supreme Court ruling on health care reform. And so the health law was passed in 2010. It was challenged in several areas and by several courts. And the Supreme Court is getting ready to rule on some of those challenges. Can you give us a brief description of what they're looking at and what they might say?
Sure. It's true, the way you described it, there were a number of challenges right after the law passed, and those have worked their way through the courts, and now we are at the Supreme Court, and that the Supreme Court will decide whether or not different parts of the law are constitutional. The one that most people are watching and most people are interested in is whether or not the individual responsibility provision, which is also known as the individual mandate, the part of the law that says everyone has to participate and has to buy health insurance coverage with a few exceptions, they will be taking up that part of the law. And there are a few other provisions that they'll be looking at. The main thing to take away from the Supreme Court discussion is that the law is already in place and it's working for millions of women and families across the country. And there are a number of areas that the Supreme Court will hear both sides of the debate, and we don't really know what's going to happen. We don't know whether or not they can strike down the entire law or they can just strike down pieces of it. That will happen over the course of the oral arguments, which are going to be happening the last week in March. And we feel strongly that it will be considered constitutional, but at the same time, we want to remind everyone that the law is actually providing real benefits to people across the country right now. It's in effect and working, and that's the biggest takeaway.
Okay, so we'll be watching that closely. I've been speaking with Anna Benyo, Senior Health Policy Analyst for the National Women's Law Center. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Giovanna. Such a pleasure.
You're tuned to Women's Health Today. I'm your host, Giovanna Rossi. Today we're talking about the impact of healthcare reform on women. And one provision of the law that's very important to women all over the country relates to breastfeeding support. The healthcare law requires employers to provide nursing mothers with reasonable unpaid breaks to express breast milk at work in a private place. Although there are substantial health benefits to both babies and mothers from breastfeeding, many working mothers lack the time and space at work to enable them to breastfeed. We know that breastfeeding provides many benefits to women and their children, and it reduces the need for sick days and lowers employers' health care and insurance costs. Employers must provide reasonable unpaid break time for mothers to express breast milk in the first year after the birth of a child. Employers must also provide a private space other than a bathroom for mothers to express breast milk, and the space must be shielded from view and free from intrusion. This provision applies to all employers, but employers with fewer than 50 employees may be exempt if they demonstrate that the requirements impose an undue hardship by creating significant difficulty or expense. Now I'm going to try to address some of the commonly asked questions about cost and timing of the new healthcare law. For example, many people wonder if their monthly premiums are going to go up. And after talking to the National Women's Law Center and reviewing other research, we can't really say for certain, but it is unlikely. There is significant evidence that many of the preventive services included in healthcare reform, such as quitting smoking, losing weight, immunizations, and contraceptives, are actually cost-saving. Another question that's asked frequently is how people know if their plan is new and if the requirements of the law apply to their plan. So health plans that existed before the healthcare reform law are considered grandfathered, and they're grandfathered into the new system under healthcare reform. Grandfathered plans don't have to follow the new preventive services or cost-sharing rules. This means that the plan can continue to operate just as it has until it makes significant changes. These changes include cutting benefits significantly, increasing coinsurance, copayments, or deductibles or out-of-pocket limits by certain amounts, decreasing premium contributions by more than 5%, or adding or lowering annual limits. So the next question is, will your plan ever become ungrandfathered and have to follow the new rule? And the answer is yes. A recent survey found that 90% of all large U.S. companies expect that their health plans will lose grandfathered status by 2014. Eventually, all plans will lose their grandfathered status, and distinctions between the two types of plans will disappear. At that point, all plans will cover these important preventive health services without cost sharing. For more information and links, go to collectiveactionstrategies.com. This has been Women's Health Today. Women's Health Today is produced at the studios at KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Our engineer today was Ramon Garcia. Theme music was composed and performed by Paul Presley. You can find a podcast of the show at kunm.org. I'm Giovanna Rossi for Women's Health Today.